Hey, folks, before you listen to this episode of the show, we just wanted to let you know that we love Mr. Stephen Graham Jones around here. Isn't that right, Eric?
Oh, man, he's one of our favorites.
One of our favorites. And we have a long running tradition of asking Mr. Jones about various insane animal encounters that he has had over the years. He is a wealth of information in that regard. We prompted him to tell another story about a crazy animal encounter on this particular show. And it gets really gnarly and it's really depressing. And we can't remove it entirely from the show. And we don't want to. We want Stephen's words to be where they are. But we do want to issue this warning. The only time we've ever had a content warning on the show, I think. Is that is that correct?
The only time. And we've talked about some really messed up stuff on this show. So that should give you an indication of how like sad and depressing that the story is and might trigger some not great responses.
Yes. So if animal death sounds like something like you just do not want to fuck with, we completely understand. In fact, you will hear me stand up and go leave to take a leak while he's telling this story. But we did figure we should issue a warning. So there it is. And, you know, do with it what you will. Eric?
I think that's all that needs to be said on that. You have been warned. It's a great episode. Can't wait for you guys to hear it. But before we dive in, you know what I have to do. I have to talk a little bit about our corporate overlords. That's right. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, which it absolutely is, impeccably designed, I might add it. It's highly collectible and it's delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including your intrepid KinkCast hosts. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you'll need to subscribe. And to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And guess what? If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive, gargantuan 25% off of your subscription.
Now, with all of that said, let's get on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Red rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes, death is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name's Scott Wampler.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. Our guest today is not new to the KingCast crowd. Either you've heard his episodes on Holly, The Monkey, or Maximum Overdrive, or you've read one of his award-winning best-selling novels, including The Only Good Indians, My Heart is a Chainsaw, and Don't Fear the Reaper. Those last two make up a two-thirds of a trilogy that he will soon complete with The Angel of Indian Lake, which hits stores on March 26th. Today, he's here to talk to us about one of our preferred schlocky King movies, 1992's Sleepwalkers, which features an original screenplay by King and the directorial efforts of another frequent KingCast guest, Mr. Mick Garris. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Stephen Graham Jones back to the KingCast stage. Stephen, how are you doing today?
Man, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me again. This was a blast watching this.
Oh, I am so dying to hear your thoughts on this because this is a first time watch. I want everybody to know going in. But before we get into that, I want to kind of address the elephant in the room, and that is, I think Scott and I have been downgraded. We didn't get an advanced copy of your new book. We got one.
Oh shit, that's true.
Well, you know what happened?
I guess we're off the holiday.
I guess we can just go fuck ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see how it is.
So I guess what happened was the publisher, I gave them a list of people to send the book to, and they got back to me and they said they got absolutely swamped with requests and all of their advanced reading copies got sucked up. So there weren't any more to go around.
What I'm hearing is you forget the people that helped get you to where you are now, who supported you when others weren't.
But he was already there when we started.
I'm pretty sure we pulled Stephen Graham Jones out of obscurity and gave him a voice on our Fangoria podcast.
Honestly, yeah. It's fine because I don't have, I have no reading time. I've got a copy of Doom a Key that's been sitting on my nightstand for a month now that I've been, I'm supposed to be reading and I haven't even picked it up.
Well, you know, y'all might be into the audio of this, of Angel of Indian Lake. Y'all heard who's doing a cameo on it, right?
Yeah.
Stephen King is a part of your fucking audiobook.
I wrote up that news for Fangoria the other day. And,
thanks, man. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm curious about it. Like, do you have, there's like half a dozen different people in there. You've also got Barbara Crampton, who's been on the show before. We love Barbara. What are you doing with these people? Like, are they reading different chapters? Are they voicing different characters?
Yep. Yeah. Like in the first one, My Heart is a Chainsaw, it was mostly one person. And then in the second one, well, I think it might've been all one person in the first one, actually. And Kara G. In the second one, it was a full cast. They cast different voice actors for all of the different characters, which was really cool.
What?
And they just, I know, and they kept that going for the third one. And the third one is a lot, it's got a lot less voices, but Barbara Crampton, you know, Frank from Hellraiser, Stephen King, Isabella Starr LeBlanc, and more and more. I'm really impressed with the names they were able to pull into this production.
That's wild. That would seem to, like it's cool as shit that they've done that, but like, doesn't that like massively overcomplicate the process of recording an audiobook to do it that way?
Probably for them, but I mean, I'm one of those people too. So I have to go to the studio here in Boulder and get voice directed from New York City by Michael Noble, the director of it. And it's weird getting voice directed. I'd never, I guess I started with Good Indians for me, maybe, where you have to, you know, Walter Child told me about this. He got voice directed by David Fincher for that Voir series they did on Netflix.
Right.
And he was explaining to me how weird it is to get voice directed by Fincher. And for me to get voice directed by anyone is weird too, because I'm not a voice actor. I don't really have those gifts of intonation and can't inhabit a character and all that. Luckily, I'm just reading the parts that I say. So the character I'm inhabiting is myself, I guess. But so hopefully that's easier. But still,
what kind of direction was he giving you?
You know, like, you get stuff like, you're coming in hot. You skipped a word. Can you hit that harder? And you
don't
and,
say that so shitty.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what it all is. Yeah. And I say everything pretty terrible. So that's the big problem, you know?
Once more, but better.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
With feeling, Stephen. With feeling.
I keep thinking I should narrate one of my audiobooks, like be the voice actor for it. But that, man, that would take like 3 weeks of me sitting in a studio in a pair of headphones. You know, I don't know if I'm up for that or not.
Yeah, I think I would hate doing that. It sounds so tedious to me. And like, you know, I remember I was dating someone at some point and was like there was a thing where like she threw out the idea of like, well, what if this is weird. Maybe I shouldn't say this on the air. Well, she was like, she was asking, she put forth the idea that like maybe like read something to me at night, like read from a book. And maybe that's a thing we could do together. Which I realize sounds insane now that I'm talking about it in public.
You were dating a
like,
kindergartner.
This is a grown woman. Yeah, this is not like a, you know, fully out of high school. I want to be clear. But like that lasted one night. And then I was like, this is weird. And also like, I don't know. Like this is, it's a tedious process to like read. Cause you're like tripping over your words or whatever. Yeah. I read faster than I speak. I think.
Yeah.
And that's a problem with reading out loud.
You know, also reading out loud, I found, you can either read out loud or you can comprehend. It's hard to do both at once.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's tough if you're like trying to do like you're saying, like inflections for the voices of the characters, like you kind of, it's easy to do that in your head, but when you're reading it out loud, not so much. It's like something in my brain clicks off and I can't.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's almost like a defensive mechanism to keep us from overloading or something, I suspect, you know.
Maybe.
You know, I remember when I would read to my kids when they were, you know, young, have to read them to sleep or get to read them to sleep. I wish I still could, but they're not going to take it when they're 24 years old, you know. But I had so many nights where I would be lying there reading to them. And I would fall asleep and I would wake up still reading, you know, which is to say like some important, like my whole body went to sleep except for some circuit from my eyes to my mouth, which was still reading. What? Which I know, weird. It's wild. Yeah, I don't understand that at all.
God, you're so weird. How can you fall asleep? Like your brain, like your mouth kept going while you were asleep.
Yeah, well, that's what would wake me up. I would hear a voice, you know, and I'd wake up to that voice.
It was yours.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this
that's
actually
bizarre.
It makes sense though, because that's a very common side effect for people who eat their steaks burnt to a crisp.
So. That's right. Yeah. That's true.
I don't know if you've
Donald Trump I've heard that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That you talking about that, like, I've never been great at reading out loud. I do the same thing. I start speeding up a little bit, and I'm not comprehending. I start like trying to skip or think, get in my own head that I'm fucking it up. You know, everybody had to do that at school where it's like, it's now they, for whatever goddamn reason, they make all the kids like, you're going to read this paragraph or this is your turn to read this. And none of the kids like listening to it. None of the kids like doing it, but they make us do it anyway. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's the Princess Bride in me, but like, I've always wanted to, you know, one thing that I've always looked forward to is like, if I started a family, having the story nights and reading to my kid. But now you're making me scared that I'm going to turn into some kind of a nighttime bedtime story reading zombie, and I don't like that. Yeah. So
I think I think that should be low on your list of concerns in terms of bringing a child into this world. I would think about like the environment, for instance, or the oncoming apocalypse.
Yeah.
Versus,
yeah,
is it going to be weird if I have to read out loud?
You know, when I was in junior high and I guess probably sixth grade and also early high school, I didn't go to all of high school, but early high school, whenever I was in English class and we were reading Canterbury Tales or something, that somehow the teachers figured out that I could pronounce those words right and get the meter right, you know, in the lines. Mm. And so they would always call on me, you know, Stephen, read this soliloquy from Shakespeare or whatever. And I would always do it. And I always knew that I'm just setting myself up for a beating, you know. Or in science class in junior high, the coach who taught our science class did not care remotely about science. And so all we did for his class was read the chapters out loud, you know. And he figured out that I could do it. And so every class, I would just read a chapter out loud. And I didn't learn any science, but I kept other people from having to read anyways, you know?
You've been training for your audiobook adventures. There you go. Since you.
Yeah.
You so, didn't even know it.
With The Angel of Indian Lake, you're bringing this trilogy to a close.
Yeah.
I know it's the Indian Lake trilogy, but I think of it as the Jade Daniels trilogy.
I think a lot of people do, yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious if, like, have you heard from Hollywood about these books?
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm always, like, ever since Chainsaw was about to come out, I've been in talks with Hollywood. I've optioned, I guess, Chainsaw once or twice, and now that Angel of Indian Lake is out, I bet I'll be optioning the whole trilogy. And I guess I can't say who on air, but I am in big talks with someone. Yeah, I think y'all would like about it anyways, you know?
Ooh.
Hmm. Interesting. Well,
well, I'd hope so. You wouldn't come on and be like, I'm going to talk to somebody. They're going to really fuck it up and you're going to hate it, but man, it's going to be a lot of money. So,
yeah. You know, I was working with Jeff Barnaby on it before he passed, and he had some great ideas of how to do it, but I guess we'll never get to do it that way, but still somebody else will figure out some other way to do it.
Yeah. When the first one was optioned a couple of times, you said, did someone produce a script?
Not yet. No, no. Or if they have, I have not seen it. Right now, there's a one sheet going around Hollywood, I hear. And I think, I'm not sure if that writer is waiting until that one sheet, you know, gets like activated to write the script or not. I'm not sure about that. But I have not seen a script yet.
Yeah, I'm curious, like how do you think you will feel about it? Like, let's say this thing gets, let's say it gets turned into a series, right? How do you think you're going to feel about it? Like seeing someone else reconstruct your words, like on the page. I mean, watching it will be something else entirely.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If somebody gave you a script for My Heart is a Chainsaw, like, do you think you would, like, how do you think you would react to that?
You know, I think my first reaction is going to be what my reaction is to all of the scripts I see produced for my stuff is, can we please put the humor back in, you know, because people, for some reason, the humor gets combed out. I don't know why. And I think the humor is vital, or it's vital to me anyways.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing I'm probably going to say. And the second thing I'm probably going to say is, man, why didn't I write the novel like this? This is so much more efficient.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you want to distill your novel down to like 107 pages, sure.
Yeah.
It's going to be quicker. Yeah. Maybe save yourself a lot of time. What's your experience with screenwriting?
I've done a lot of it. I've been in writer's rooms. I've done feature film stuff for, you know, established directors, and I've been fired. I think that's probably your rite of passage when you get fired. It's not when you get something produced.
What'd you get fired for?
Because the notes that kept coming back were not notes I could deal with. I guess I won't say any names, but the note I kept getting was, this is really great, but what if there was no dialogue? And I just could not figure out how to do this. I just could not figure out how to do a script without dialogue.
You can make a movie that way.
Yeah.
But especially if you're adapting, well, I guess you're not adapting yourself though in this case, right?
Yeah. No, I wasn't. No. But it was complicated. I still don't know how to do that.
Just the difference between writing prose, writing a novel, writing a script, do you prefer one over the other?
Actually, I like them probably both equally. I like the process of production and getting to the shelf of novels a whole lot better, because with Hollywood, there's bigger dollars at stake, and so the suggestions you get aren't actually suggestions, they're demands. And they're often demands from people who didn't actually read the piece. They kind of maybe read somebody's report on that piece, and it all gets really complicated. And then you have stuff like, the scene with the rain is great, but rain costs a lot, so you can do something different, you know, all that kind of stuff. You don't have those problems in novels. In novels, you've got an endless special effects budget.
Sure.
Yeah. And you can cast anybody you want as long as you don't use Brad Pitt's name or something, you know?
Who would you cast as Jade Daniels?
Man, that's a good question. A lot of people say Devery Jacobs from Reservation Dogs, and she could kill it, of course. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they said Zendaya is your obvious choice for Letha, and I had never even considered that.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I've seen her in is Dune, and she's in that for 32 seconds, you know?
Right. You see Dune 2?
She's great.
No, I've been trying to get away for days and days to see Dune 2, and I wanted to go yesterday, but yesterday was a monstrous snowfall, and so I felt like if I went to the theater, then I was making theater workers be there, and what if one of them got hurt on the way to the theater because I had to watch a stupid movie, and I couldn't really handle that, so I skipped out.
Right. Well, yeah, I took about 70 milligrams worth of edibles before I saw Dune 2, and I'm here to tell you, fantastic.
Yeah.
just blew me the fuck away. I couldn't probably coherently tell you what happens in that movie, I was riveted. I was on board. Nice. I can't wait to see it again with a fresh set of eyes.
I'm so excited. I want to see it. I love the novel, of course, but it's going to be neat seeing the sandworms actually out and doing stuff, you know.
Oh yeah,
out and about,
yeah,
poking around
more than just popping up and saying hello every once in a while.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
You are one of very few guests we have ever had on the show that I can imagine riding a sandworm.
matter of fact, I'm going to be shocked if you haven't somehow done this. Or some equivalent with some other monstrous beast.
Yeah.
When were you last on Arrakis? So we don't need to do your. We're way past the point of needing to do your Stephen King origin story, but we are here today to talk about Sleepwalkers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 1992's Mick Garris, Stephen King's Sleepwalkers. This is a movie that, I rewatched it last night with my roommate, Tony, and she was not a fan. I'm going to tell you something.
Oh, ooh. Wow. Yeah.
But I think that's how do I put this? I think that's a common reaction to Sleepwalkers on first viewing is like, what? And then, you know, if let's say you're hosting a Stephen King podcast and you have to watch Sleepwalkers over and over and over again, you find the good in it, right? I don't necessarily think this is a quote unquote good movie, but I think it is a supremely entertaining movie. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, my roommate, she just wasn't there yet. But yeah. This, you know, we brought this title to you, and specifically because you hadn't seen it before. And I'm curious. Well, first of all, can you lay out the plot for anyone who hasn't seen it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it starts with that little, what do you call it at the first? It's not an epigraph. It's like a definition on screen talking about what a sleepwalker is. Kind of redefining sleepwalker for us.
Talking
about how they're basically the origin of vampires. And then we are sucked into the story such that we start at the end of one cycle and of these sleepwalkers being in a town and having lots of cat problems and then having to jump to the next town. And at that next town, they target this one girl, Tanya Robertson, I guess is her name. And it's a mom and a son who are, I don't know, I want to say incestuous. We can talk about that. And they have to feed off the life.
Wait, what do you mean I don't want to say incestuous? They're absolutely fucking.
Well, no, they definitely are. But I think being a different species and being a species of such like thin population, like number one, inline breeding is the only way they can probably, you know, reproduce or have maintain their population. But at the same, but also being a different species, it seems like sex is how they transfer this life force that they siphon off of other people. Mm. So, I think for them, sex is just like the trigger, the mechanism for transferring life force. So we look at it as incestuous, but
they seem to like it a whole lot.
No, they do.
What you're saying, best-selling author Stephen Graham Jones are saying right now in public is that sometimes incest is okay if you are a bipedal werecat.
Yeah, pretty much, I guess.
All right. You know? Fair enough.
But they have lots of I don't know, friction trying to steal this girl's life force. And
yes.
It involves a police officer and his sidekick cat. What is it called?
Yeah. Clovis.
Clovis the Attack Cat. Attack Cat. And some bad cars in there. This is a movie about that. That blue Trans Am with the honeycomb rims, the pinstriping, the leather interior, the T-tops. That is a bad car. It's got that Ram Air. I mean, that car can move. I am so impressed with that car.
Little pause. Everybody listening to this should sign up for our Patreon and listen to the Cujo commentary that Stephen Graham Jones joined us for. And if you like him talking about cars, wait till you get a load of that commentary. That is the most car-focused commentary that's ever existed. I don't even know if there's commentaries on the Fast and the Furious movies, but if there are, there is less talk about cars than there is on the Cujo one that we recorded.
I remember less car talk and more. My main memory of recording that commentary was that Stephen Graham Jones watches movies in a completely different way than I do. You know, like normally, or like, well, I don't want to say normal because what's normal, but yeah, I think that we can say like broadly that people tend to focus on the action that's happening on screen and not Mr. Stephen Graham Jones. We'll be like, look at that coffee can over in the corner. And you're like, what? Like, what the fuck? I don't remember that label. I don't think that's period appropriate. So then what happens?
So then they try to suck this girl's life force. They have to kill a lot of people not a lot, but they have to kill a small handful of people to get this done. And it ends up being a big, big standoff in a single night with like a legion of cats. You know, cats are drawn to these sleepwalkers. And when a cat scratches these sleepwalkers, give it like about 10 seconds and that little wound kind of separates into flame, which is a weird monster dynamic to me. And, and the good guys nominally win. It's a lot of sacrifice to get there, but the bad guys are put down anyways, which is what we want from any kind of monster story, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's my first question. Do we think at the end of Sleepwalkers, do we think all the sleepwalkers have been snuffed out? Is that the end of that bloodline?
Yeah, you know, I feel we don't actually see the son meet his final end, do we? Mm. He's He's still in the house. Is that right? We see the mom.
Like taking a nap on the couch.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much.
But the house burns down. Yes.
The house does burn down. Yeah. But that's like movie. That's like horror movie code for they snuck out the back door for the sequel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
No body, no death. Yeah.
The
yeah,
old exactly. Michael Myers. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. And, but I do think the mom dies. I feel like she's not with us anymore.
Mom's gone. Let's assume then for the purposes of the conversation that they're both dead. Do you think that's it? Like, are these the only two ones, or do you think this thing could go international?
No, I think it is international. I feel like don't they say somewhere that they haven't sensed any more sleepwalkers for a long time? They are I feel like they are a rare breed, possibly a dying breed, but I do feel like there's more sleepwalkers in the world. I mean, at one time there was a lot of them because it opens with those Ken Burns movements across the pages, you know, the hieroglyphs and all that stuff.
Yeah,
that used to be the bane of humans, I feel like, but as we've become more sophisticated and learned better tricks, we've put more and more of them down. Or maybe since there's been more cats, I don't know.
I think that's the thing there is that cats are just everywhere. You know, when this is like if these were all supermen and suddenly everybody had a fucking one to four kryptonites in their house. You know what I mean? Sure. It's like,
I agree.
Yeah, it's like it's going to be real tougher for those things to live.
No, it definitely is.
But yeah, there's always going to be some more out there. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some that are, I don't know, off. Where are there no cats? Antarctica?
Yeah, you know, maybe
there'll be stuff up there. Yeah,
yeah, I think there are for sure. And you know, who knows? Maybe they like. Maybe there's like subspecies that aren't as vulnerable to cats. Mm. You know. Yeah.
What if they're a daywalker sleepwalker? Yeah. That's the sequel. It's daywalkers.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, you know, Scott, you're talking about how people generally kind of revile this movie. I really think that people would be drawn to it, or they wouldn't resist it so much if it weren't called Sleepwalkers. If it were just called instead, like, you know, Cat People 3, the curse or something like that, you know?
The Hissening.
Yeah, the Hissening. I like that because calling it Sleepwalkers makes us have to makes that little definition have to come up at first so we can redefine what a sleepwalker is. And then the whole time we're wondering about this new class of monsters. How do they work? And so a whole lot of the story is spent figuring out what they're vulnerable to, what their powers are. I mean, apparently they can make cars go transparent, which is a heck of an ability to have, you know?
They can transform their faces into children and or mutated cats and or blonde-haired teenagers. Yeah,
exactly.
But your pitch here is that the title is the problem.
I think that's what I think. Yeah, because I like this movie, man.
I think it's a cheesy movie. Is the truth, you know? Yeah. It's schlocky, it's cheesy, it's got a cat boy fucking his cat mom in it. Like there's a lot going on here, and I think that the average person who like say was showing up to a theater in '92 or catching this on HBO, all they know it's a Stephen King movie. Like it'll be a scary thing, and then it's this, and it's a little more like Mick Garris does not direct this as Romero directed Creepshow, but it's like a Creepshow thing almost. Uh-huh. Like that's the tone, but it doesn't necessarily look like that aesthetically. And I think that if it were, you know, it had more of those touches to it, like, you know, bold lighting, that kind of, again, the Creepshow aesthetic, I think people would like it more. I don't think people are seeing, like, my roommate who watched it last night, like, I don't think her problems with the movie had anything to do with the title, you know, but fair enough.
I can see that, like, because I have vague memories as being a kid when I watched this movie, thinking like, oh, sleepwalkers, and picturing some kind of Freddy Krueger style thing, like Stephen King and Freddy Krueger esque thing. And you're right, Scott, in that the way the movie looks isn't like telling you it's kind of a partially a comedy, which it absolutely is. I mean,
it's arch is the word.
Yeah, a man gets stabbed to death with an ear of corn in this movie. You know, it's like you know, you have that whole the whole Stephen King cameo sequence, which is a fucking hilarious gag. Like it's just joke after joke after joke at a fucking death scene of somebody. You know, at like a fucking crime scene. It's like there is a lot of comedy in this, and you're right that there aren't. you know,
visual Garris, signposts.
We will need to get Mick back on the show at some point, because I'd love to ask him about, you know, his thoughts on just the look of Sleepwalkers, and because it's, you know, obviously I think he's going for, and maybe it's just because what's her name, Mad Jin is in it, but that he's going for a little kind of Twin Peaks ish thing where it's a kind of a serious looking thing that has all this ridiculous crazy stuff going on in it, you know. I'm wondering if that has anything, if that was any influence on the look of this movie.
Yeah, that's a good question. But, you know, talking back to the title, like Sleepwalkers, to me, y'all probably seen people sleepwalk, and that is one of the most terrifying things I've witnessed, you know, to see somebody walking around under a power that you can't identify, you know?
Yeah.
Sleepwalkers are fundamentally disturbing. And so when we suddenly understand that sleepwalkers are just cat monster people, that dials the terror level down a whole lot for me anyways, you know, because
I have never seen someone sleepwalk in
real life.
But I have done it on occasions and scared the ever loving shit out of some people. Some, like, back when Birth Movies Death was in operation, we used to go out every year and cover Comic-Con in San Diego, and Birth Movies Death was owned by the Alamo Draft House, and the owner of the Alamo Draft House knew a guy in San Francisco who had a condo like two blocks over from where that convention building was, and this guy would like rent us his place every year, and he would just go out of town for 2 weeks because he didn't want to deal with the crowds or deal with all the bullshit of Comic-Con. It was like right there, you know. And so he would leave, we'd shack up at his place, you know, great arrangement.
Yeah.
The first time I went out there, well, I got a little tipsy. I don't mind telling you. And I fell asleep on the couch. There are two bedrooms. One of them had my former colleague, Evan Sathoff, in it. And the other one had my other former colleague, Meredith Borders, in it. And here are some things that I did while I was asleep. I got up and went to the bathroom and then forgot. Like, I wasn't aware of where I was, apparently. You know, I don't remember this. But I went into Evan's room and then got into bed with him. And he woke up and was like, "Scott, what the fuck are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry, man." And I realized, oh, this isn't my, like, I'm navigating this unknown piece of geography, you know, the interior of this place, like, while 2% awake, and I thought I was at home, and somehow in my brain, I thought I was going back into bed with my then wife, right? Well, then the next thing I did was I went out to the living room with a connected kitchen. I took the stove apart, apparently.
Wow.
I don't remember doing this either. Like, Eben had to like put it all back together the next morning, but like,
wow.
I did that. And then I went into Meredith's bedroom and stood in the fucking corner facing the wall.
Blair Witch
style. And she woke up and screamed. And that's what finally woke me up. And I was like, holy shit. Like, you know, and so I went back to sleep on the couch, and the next day I had a lot to answer for. I gotta apologize to Evan. I gotta apologize to the stove. I Blair Witched Meredith. They were clearly terrified.
So
I believe you, but I've never actually experienced. I can imagine how it would be like fucking shocking though.
Yeah, it's scary, man.
Yeah,
it's I've never really experienced that other than, like, you know, I've been with you know, like, longtime girlfriends or something that'll sit up in the middle of the night and say something to somebody in the room and then lay back down.
Sure,
and I'm sure I've done the same shit, but like, there is something that gets in just instantly under your skin about that. It's like what the fuck is this? It's like, are you pulling back the veil for me right now, or are you just are you just like, you know, asleep and not you know, and not yourself?
Exactly. Yeah, like whose hand puppet are you right now? You know,
Who is there? Somebody's, is that a Scott Wampler standing in the corner?
Imagine you wake up and I'm standing there Blair Witching you. That'd be fucking, I would shit my pants. It's awful. off.
No, I'm thinking of the place we rented when we did that that Danvers thing in Massachusetts, and we're on like opposite sides of this condo. If I had woken up one night and you were just standing in the corner, that bed would have had to have been replaced. I would have shot through the sheets, through the mattress, and onto the floor. Yeah,
you know, I know somebody. Somebody, she often ties her feet together with pantyhose, so because she's really bad about sleepwalking. But that'll keep, if she trips when she gets out of bed, that wakes her up, you know.
Yeah, and you get dangerous and fucking shit too. It's like Mike Birbiglia has that whole stand up special about how he fucking walked himself through a fucking window on the second floor of a Holiday Inn once.
Yeah.
If you tie your feet together though, like, aren't you like waking up and immediately face planting into the ground?
Yeah. Yep. Yep, but it's better than point. Better than going in a better than
so
going
possibly breaking your nose is better than what else was she up to? What was going on while she was sleepwalking?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but there's always the fear that you're going to walk out on the road or get a knife or something, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so what do you think about this? The special effects in this movie, Stephen?
You know, the hand gag really worked. The transformations into the cat faces looked very. What is it?
Yes, the morphing technology.
Yeah, early 90s morphing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, for sure.
The black or white video or two,
Yeah. It looked kind of weird. It wasn't completely necessary. I mean, in retrospect, it's not necessary. I'm sure at the time in 92, they're like, wow, this is cutting edge. You know, we're going to be like James Cameron in the Abyss and change the world, you know. But but it feels weird now. It'd be nice if they did like Bad Moon and went back and dialed the CGI back, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I like that it's a kind of a snapshot of a time and place.
Yeah.
It's one of the
charming
things I think about this movie, and
and
you know, maybe it's something that future generations won't appreciate the way that I do, but it, you know, because it is nostalgic for me watching movies like this.
Yeah, it is.
And, well, you know and remembering what that era was like. Yeah,
no, for sure. And you know, talking about the look and feel of this film, because I'd never seen it before. Watching it now, it feels like it's 100% part of the on-ramp up to Scream, you know, like the way it looks is so Scream. And you even got lines. You've got one of Charlie saying, just look at this shirt, my mother's going to kill me. And then you got Stu and Scream saying, my mom and dad are going to be so mad. Like, they're
right.
And this mix of horror and comedy is very Scream as well. So, I kind of wonder, I mean, I know Kevin Williamson was inhaling all the slashers, but I don't doubt that he might have seen Sleepwalkers too, or some of the cast might have and incorporated.
Oh, he had to.
Yeah, incorporated some of it. Yeah.
I'm sort of shocked that you had never seen this.
Man,
because,
me too. Yeah.
You know, you're a guy who sees most horror movies.
I do.
You know?
I am, yeah.
And
yeah,
this seems like prime.
Yeah.
You know, you living in a house filled with spiders or whatever the fuck you were doing during 1992. Yeah. Like, this seems like a thing you would have picked up at the video store or something.
It totally does. But 92, I was 20 years old. I was a sophomore in Lubbock, Texas at Texas Tech University. And I had no extra money. I think Unforgiven was one of the very few movies I saw at the theater in that little span of years. I even saw Popcorn on VHS at the end of the decade because I didn't catch it at the theater.
Oh, wow.
You know? So I missed a lot of stuff. There's like a 2 or 3 year period where I missed out on a lot of stuff just because if I was lucky, I could save like $3 over the course of the week. And I always spent that on a Whopper on Sunday, you know.
What dorm were you in at Tech?
Murdo. Were you there?
No shit. Stengel Murdo.
Yeah.
Yep, I was in that one too.
Really? Oh wow! I was on the fourth floor. That's where I usually live. Sometimes I live on the second. I was on the fourth though. Yeah.
That's
so cool.
Crazy.
We used to figured out a way to sneak up on the roof, and we would get a 3-person slingshot. We'd steal all the grapefruit from the cafeteria, and we'd go up onto the roof of Murdo, and we would just soar these grapefruits like a quarter mile away to hit the soccer players, and they would always come over to fight us and try to, you know, it was pretty fun.
This is some Revenge of the Nerd shit right here.
Yeah, Tech was a lawless place.
Man,
yeah, that's why I lasted precisely one semester, and then I was like, all right, I'm just wasting someone's money here. I need to, you know, I need to leave.
Yeah. That's where I met the girl who I'm married to now. And that's also, I broke my ribs.
No shit.
I broke my ribs down in that sand volleyball pit too, man.
There's nothing else to do in Lubbock but break your ribs.
I'll
give you that. Or shoot grapefruits at people. Not a lot of culture in Lubbock, Texas.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Thank you for bringing us into the ad space, Dr. Zombie. I am here to tell you about our show sponsor this week, which is a book by the name of Murder Road by Simone St. James, which, you know, according to the ad copy I've been given, is the scariest read of 2024. Here it is. April and Eddie have taken a wrong turn. Lost in the dark, the honeymooners are suddenly transfixed by a ghoulish glow amidst the passing trees. Until a young woman appears from the light as if summoned. Does she need help? Is she a hitchhiker or a threat? But she's alone and stumbling in the dark. They take a chance and offer her a lift. The woman slouches in the back seat. April notices the dark wetness of blood beneath the woman's jacket slowly drip and pool in her seat. And then she speaks, her voice faint. I'm sorry. Two headlights pierce the dark behind them. He's coming. Ingeniously plotted and heart-stoppingly terrifying, join April and Eddie on their honeymoon from hell, uncovering the haunting secret of Murder Road. Now available for U.S. readers and coming soon on the 28th of March for those of you listening in the U.K.
Very well done, Scott. I got goosebumps.
Oh.
You got mad radio voice there going on delivering all that stuff. I loved it.
Why, thank you.
All right. But you know what else I love is getting back into the show. Let's love do it. Love it. So I'd like to kind of go back to something that Steven touched on, and that is this very weird era. This is a very weird piece of time for horror films, right? Mm-hmm. So you're like kind of early 90s horror is bizarre. That's like the rise of the direct-to-video mm-hmm. horror thing. You have the fall of like the 80s slasher, you know, domination, and like before Scream comes on this scene, it's like you had some elegant horror, you had like the Miseries and Silence of the Lambs and whatnot, but for the most part, like, there isn't a whole lot of room for something like Sleepwalkers in this era. This is something that if it had come out 2 years later, you know, it would have been a direct-to-video movie, right?
Yeah, I agree.
And it's, so I don't know, it's a really, and it's another thing that I really like about this movie is it's kind of a time capsule of that like really bizarre transition period between the Friday the 13th and mm-hmm. the Scream, you know, which would kind of dominate, you know, the horror definition.
Yeah. It was a little pocket of time when Silence of the Lambs was taking up the horror space, you know?
Right. Well, then, and that's when everybody started trying to change the definition of horror into thriller. If it was done with any kind of budget and or star power, then it became a thriller. Even if somebody's flaying somebody open and displaying them like a fucking butterfly on a cage, you know, that's a psychological thriller. That one,
because it makes you think.
Yeah, but so it's
blood. Fuck off! It's a horror movie.
there's many subgenres in horror, so you can still be horror. I don't know, there's just something about it which kind of contributes to the odd man out status that I think this movie has, because it's off kilter itself. It's it's out in a time when like people didn't really fucking have an idea of what horror was going to be. Like, we're talking about like the big studio horror movies around this era where you're like Brain Scan and Man's Best Friend and Ghost in the Machine, and like none of those really like fucking hit the, you know, I don't know, mainstream, I guess, in a way. And Sleepwalkers feels kind of like the king of that, of like even the weirdo amongst the weirdos, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so. No, I totally agree, man. Yeah. It does.
I don't have a question there. It's just something once you mentioned that, like, oh, maybe it was influenced Scream. I'm like, yeah, holy shit. There was that weird dead zone in the late 80s, early 90s.
Dead zone. Nice.
Yeah, a literal dead zone. But I do have a question for Steven, and that is, you know, we've heard many snake, spider, dog, encounters. We're talking about a movie with a lot of angry cats in it. Do you have any angry cat or scary cat encounters? Big cats, small cats, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to preempt this and say whatever he's about to say is going to be awful.
I guess I have been traumatized by cat stuff. Not particularly happy stories, but you know, probably the scariest cat thing. Like, I used to move pipe every morning before school. Moving pipe is going out into the cotton field, and
I do that every morning myself.
And there's 40-foot aluminum joints of pipe, and you have to pick them up. You have to unlatch them at each end. It's like a twisting motion that you learn. Then you walk it 8 or so rows over and set it down. You connect them all back again, because these irrigation lines can't move by themselves. They need a person that can move pipe. And I remember one morning, finding a big mountain lion track right in the mud by one of the sprinklers, which was made that pipe moving session pretty cool, you know, because it's West Texas. We don't like up here in Boulder, seeing a big cattail hanging from a tree is no big deal, but seeing a mountain lion down in West Texas, you know, that dude's gonna be hungry because there's not a lot to eat for it, you know, so it's a little bit scary. But that's not really a good cat story, you know. When I was 13, maybe 14, I think I was 13 though. Yeah, I was 13. We had this old Buick Bonneville. Was it a Bonneville Brougham? That's what it was. Big old junky car. And in winter, I would always get tasked with going out to start it before school so it could warm up. And usually I'd have to spray ether into the carburetor and work the little butterfly flaps and get everything going. But I was really proud because I had keys in my hand. You know, I was 13 years old.
Right.
And made me feel like an adult. And so I loved doing that. One morning I go out there, you know, trying to turn the engine over and finally get it going, and it catches. And the reason it catches is, of course, because there's a cat under the hood sleeping on the warm engine block from the night before. And it got chewed up by the fan blade a little, or the belt.
Not sure. A little.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean,
just a smidge.
It didn't kill it. That was the thing. Because when my stepdad came out there, when I told him something's under the hood, I don't know what. He came out there, popped the hood, and sure enough, there's that cat flopping around. And it wasn't quite dead yet. And he said, "You want to kill it?" And I was like, "No." And he said, "All right." So he grabs it by the back legs and the tail and walks to the rear bumper of his truck and just starts slamming its head against the bumper until it dies. And
he did it
like practically while holding his coffee in his other hand, you know. And that was traumatic. Oh, you know, I've got a more traumatic story with a cat, I guess. Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought about cat stories in a long time.
A more traumatic story?
Yeah.
than watching your stepdad beat an injured cat to death on the bumper of a fucking Buick or whatever the fuck that was?
He's going to say, "Oh, man, one time I was riding my bike on down the, like, a mountain trail, and I fucking ate a cat, like, head first. Still alive, screaming the whole way. And then I got divorced." And, like, fucking, how much more traumatic?
This one's worse, man. This
we're
one
gonna get flagged by the ASPCA somehow on just storytelling on this.
Probably.
You're the guest. Please go ahead.
I think I'm 12 years old here. Maybe old 11, somewhere right around there. Anyways, sixth grade, and we're living in this little bitty house way out in the country. It was a free house that one of my great uncles kind of had, and nobody was living in it. We didn't have nowhere to live, so he stashed us there. And we're right by the horse pens and the horse trap and all these burn barrels. And we had this young cat. She was barely a year old. And she ran away for a few days, came back pregnant. And then very shortly after that, she threw her litter. And she was so young when she had her kittens that it was just a kitten, and it was a very malformed, not going to make it kitten. Like, it, when it was born back by the burn barrels, it didn't have, like, the right kind of eyes. It was just all messed up. There was no way this thing was going to live, you know?
What do you mean the right kind of eyes?
Like, they were just very wrong. Very wrong eyes.
What does that mean?
Like in the wrong space or too many of them? Like, what's the,
no, they were in the right place, but they were not formed.
They were on her
yet.
Feet.
It was kind of like a fish eye. It was like a film on the outside, you know, and it was born really prematurely. And I don't think this young cat had the,
you know,
machinery.
What? I'm going to take a leak. I don't want to hear the rest of this. I'll be back in a minute.
Anyway, back then it was always real cold in that house, and it was winter as well. And so every morning when we woke up, my mom, we each of us boys only had one pair of pants, and so we had to wash them every single day. And so she would wake up and put our pants in the dryer so they could be warm when we went to school. And she had, for some reason, I guess to take trash out, gone to the burn barrels and seen this, like, wrong kitten that was born out there. And so me and my brother are sitting there at the table eating cereal, Fruit Loops or ABCs or whatever. And she says, she pulls me aside and says, because at the time I was the oldest, like, male in the house at what, 11 or 12, I guess. And she said, "Steven, there's something out by the burn barrels that I need you to take care of." And I was like, "Okay." And she pulled me away from my brother to tell me, and she said, "You know, our cat's had a kitten and it's not going to live. So somebody needs to put it out of its misery." And so, you know, trying to be grown up, I said, "Sure, I'll do it." And my pants were still in the dryer and they were still too wet to put on. So I put on some shorts, some basketball shorts and some cowboy boots. I put on my uncle's cowboy boots that I had that were really tall, went up over my knees. And I stagger out there to the burn barrel and I see this.
Oh my God, this is still, go ahead.
Yeah, I see this.
Cat you didn't miss the climax of the story, Scott. He was saving.
I'm glad there's a burn barrel involved because I think that's going to play a role at some point.
Chekhov's burn barrels.
Yeah.
Well, there was a little like concrete pad that my great uncle had poured to set the burn barrels on so they wouldn't set the pasture on fire. And that's where that kitten was lying. And so I saw it there lying down there panting in the cold. Like, I was honestly, hell, it was alive. It should not have been alive. And I knew I needed to kill it. But I also was right by the horse pen, so I couldn't shoot a shotgun because the horses would freak out. And so I was going to have to kill it another way. And so I went over to the barn, and I came back with a cinder block. And I so distinctly remember standing over that cat, holding that cinder block over my head, telling myself, now you can do this. And finally I did it, just crushed. I had to do it really fast and hard because I didn't want that cat to suffer anymore.
Right.
And when I did it, it misted this fine blood just all over my bare legs. And so I went inside and wiped that off with a washcloth and put my warm pants on and went to school. And
see, if I was in your situation,
I want to welcome everyone who just left a 1-star review on on iTunes. We had nothing to do with that. That was Stephen Graham Jones, who brained a fucking kitten with a cinder block and is now talking about it openly on the show. I would not tell that story again, is the first thing I would do.
But it was nice. It was nice because that cat was not going to make it, you know?
It was an act of compassion. I get it, but still, if I was in your situation, and you said you were like what, 11 or 12 at this point?
Yeah.
If I had to do that tomorrow, then just open up the padded cell. I'm in there for the rest of my life. But as a kid, like they'd still be looking for me. I just would have walked like blank eyed into the woods and never to be seen again. Like I couldn't
becoming like a feral mountain Vespy.
Yes.
Living off the land.
Well, yeah. You know, after we start recording, I'll tell you all another cat story.
I don't want to hear another fucking cat story from you.
This one's all good to be happy. He saves the happy ones for when it's not. I kind of miss the days when it was like, oh yeah, well, I just picked up a snake on the fucking highway. The last two times you've come on and we've asked for animal stories, I think we've gone through all the like, oh wow, outside crazy, I found a spider shrine or whatever. Like we've run through all those, and now we're just into the sad shit.
We are like three episodes away from Steven being like, I skull fucked a dolphin to death. On accident.
Oh, I was
going to work and it just happened.
He wasn't going to make it though, so I was doing it out of compassion.
Did I tell y'all about when a spider laid eggs in me? Did I tell y'all that?
You know what? We're not going to do this.
Okay, let's not do this.
Okay.
We got to save
absolutely
something for the next
fucking
episode.
Not. So what did you think about the performances?
Let's talk about Alice Krieger.
Let's get this fucker back on track.
Now, you know, you were talking about this early 90s kind of little horror bubble or whatever, and they had some money to lay down on this too, I guess because King was attached, but the songs they play, I was really I was compelled by the soundtrack here. You know, I was really impressed with it.
Yeah, I wonder, there was a time where the record companies and the artists realized that, holy shit, we're leaving billions on the table by optioning this music cheap. You listen to any random soundtrack from an 80s like teen sex comedy or something.
Yeah.
And it's going to be like that soundtrack today in Needle Drops would cost like $40 million.
Oh, easily.
You know, you have Zeppelin and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You know, it's like you get what I mean? It's like you have that stuff. But yeah, this is like right around that era where they fucking finally started figuring that out.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden all the Needle Drops got really shitty.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, I was looking at the trivia for this, and Mick Garris says the one song he selected from the batch he got sent for promotional purposes that he liked, he thought fitted. I forget which title it was, but that was like an eye opener for me. I had no idea that that's the way it used to work, that like the record companies had songs they wanted to promote. So they
interesting.
They send them to Hollywood for placement. You know, I had no idea that happened.
That's a smart idea.
Yeah, it is, man. It really is. That's the first place I ever heard One Headlight. It was in that Benicio del Toro, Alicia Silverstone, Excess Baggage, you know?
Oh, right. Yeah. I remember that movie.
Yeah.
But good. When we say the soundtrack, like what songs are you thinking of? Because I looked up the soundtrack like last night when we were watching this, I was like, you know, it's got Sleepwalk in it, you know, which is obviously a classic. Mm-hmm. But Do You Love Me is the other song.
Mm-hmm.
And followed by incomprehensibly, there is an Enya song. Over the end credits.
That's the one that Mick Garris picked that they sent to him, I think, man.
Mm. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. That's amazing to me.
Yeah,
like,
no, it is.
To me, that's like the weirdest inclusion in this entire thing. Is like, you know, the subtitles popped up on screen. And it was like, Enya sings.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the song is called. Yeah. I was like, Enya? Yeah. Fucking Enya on this?
Yeah.
We gotta get Enya on the show, Scott.
But you know, do you know Enya? Speaking of people living in castles, as we were talking about before the show, Enya lives in a castle somewhere and just hangs out there. Did you know that? Like,
no,
doesn't do anything anymore. Just you know, made all her money and just hangs out in a castle.
Nice.
So she's free to come on the show is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Great.
If we could get Enya on this show, do you know how excited I would be to talk to Enya?
The lawnmower man with Enya.
Like, oh, man.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Children of the Corn 7 with Enya.
My mother took so many baths listening to your music.
I don't think I even know who she is, man.
Yeah, yeah, it's I don't know either.
Yeah,
I probably shouldn't be you know, I'm not talking shit about Enya, but I shouldn't be talking anything about Enya. I'm not that well educated, but like I read a thing about, like, I don't know, somewhere within the last like few years where it was like, where is Enya now? And and like the article was like, well, Enya lives in a fucking castle and does whatever the fuck Enya wants, and that's it. Like,
nice, like, nice. Living the dream. Word.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, imagine that.
But you know, the soundtrack on here, the needle drops, they felt very Christine to me, you know, like
sure.
It made it feel like a King thing, you know, and that made me really happy, man.
Do you think that's intrinsic to the King feel?
Like, I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah. Mm. Well, I think it's intrinsic to me, to his feel anyways. I think because Christine was probably the second King novel I ever read. And so that kind of became my template for how a King novel should be, you know?
He also loves like fucking dad rock though. Like he's into butt rock fucking AC/DC, like, you know, that kind of shit.
No, so am I. So that, like when the soundtrack for The Wrestler, that was one of the best soundtracks I've ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, I love that kind of music, man. Yeah.
But like, what do you make of that? Like, a song like Sleepwalk sounds like a King story to me, right?
Oh, yeah.
But his actual disposition is, like, he wants to hear fucking, you know, Thunderstruck. Isn't there something interesting about that? Isn't there something interesting about, like, that this kind of old-timey music, for lack of a better term, sort of evokes the feeling of reading a King thing. Whereas, meanwhile, King's over here, like, you know, I want to hear electric guitars.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that either what the people who adapt him or he himself, like, discovered was that, you know, in prose fiction, you can modulate the, I don't know, the rhythm and stuff to evoke the texture you want. But when you're doing something on the big screen or the small screen, if you do the right needle drop, that can provide that texture, you know, that it, like, we all have associations with this or that song, and they're not gonna be the same associations, but they're gonna be in the same family of feelings, I suspect. And and so you can just cue that song up and not even play at all, and it's going to put us into that emotional space we need to be, to be more receptive to this scene, this moment, this development, whatever it is.
Further question, like, and I'm specifically thinking about the song Sleepwalk here, right? Like, that song makes me feel nostalgic, but it was also recorded in like fucking 59. Mm. What do you make of that? Mm. Just, I mean, like, this is an existential question.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't, you know, that, like the idea of being nostalgic for a time period that you absolutely weren't even close to seeing.
Right.
No, you're totally right. I think King has done that for his readership, and his readership is nearly every single person in the world, it seems like, because that's his childhood. You know, those are the things that to him, I suspect that they feel vital in a way that's not like alloyed by your critical defenses. You know, is when you get older, and when you get older, you're like, yeah, that's this person singing it, but I know what they did, so I can't totally love it. But like when you're 11 years old or something and you're hearing a song, it gets to you in a different way and it lodges deeper than other songs do,
right.
I feel like. And King, I think King, like anybody born in his era, like anybody born in any era really, has those feelings. And because he is such a dominating presence on the scene, I think his nostalgia for that era has kind of infected us all. I mean, maybe that's why we get that old song in Autopsy of Jane Doe, you know? It works in that same way, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's I think two prongs here.
Great.
I love it. I think there's two prongs here because you have one where sometimes there's the creepy old song, I think, in like Ready or Not, then Run Rabbit, you know, doing that kind of shit. Sometimes old, like tinny sounding music is creepy. So that goes great there. But then the reason why, like, I totally agree with you, Scott, because I am hugely nostalgic for 50s and 60s rock. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think it's because all the stuff I was watching in the 80s was all the then adults being nostalgic about their childhood, reading Stephen King, reading all that stuff, listening. I listened to the fucking Stand By Me soundtrack over and over and over again. You know, it's like I would listen to that. And I would venture to say that you were going to see this current generation being nostalgic for the 80s, even though they never lived it in the same way we were nostalgic for certain elements of the
50s. You would venture to 50s. See, like, fucking 80s love is all over the place.
No, I'm not talking, well, the love is there. I'm saying nostalgia. When these kids that are, like, you know, late teens, early 20s now, and when they're our age, they're going to have the same amount of nostalgia for the 80s that they never lived in, that the people who did live in it have, but, you know, but they're going to have it through a pop culture lens, you know? Mm-hmm. Just like we have nostalgia for the 50s and 60s based on pop culture lens. Yeah.
I wonder if Happy Days like veered us all into that space, you know,
it kind of, right?
It romanticized the 50s. It never really was, but we nevertheless came to subscribe to it. You know,
I've never seen an episode of Happy Days.
Oh really? Oh man. No. I used to be so invested in Joni and Chachi getting together and all of it, man. I lived by that show. That show and Father Knows Best and Three's Company. They're like part of my DNA that I can never shake, man.
Yeah, I mean, that there was a huge thing, like the original Nick at Night. Like, I was watching black and white TV as a 80s, 90s kid. I was watching Mr. Ed, Green Acres.
Yeah.
Like, all that stuff. And I was going to say they don't do that now, but, like, oddly enough, I'm trying to think of the time difference. I don't think the office is getting to the place where it's almost as old as some of these shows were when I was watching him going, God damn, the Dobie Gillis is fucking ancient. Yeah. Look at this black and white Patty Duke.
Man, you're right.
So you ancient. Know, but, like, the office, I think, is kind of getting close. We're about to 20 years from when it premiered. Yeah.
Okay, I would like to do a thought experiment now.
Yes.
You have been hired by Netflix.
Hmm.
To launch and write a new gritty street level dark version of Mr. Ed. What does this look like? Like, how are you doing that?
How to keep it from getting crazy. We're
bringing it in for a new audience, just like they're doing with the new Crow.
Yeah,
you know, or the new Crow looks like fucking Post Malone. Yeah. So, you know, like,
Mr. Ed's going to have Disturbed tattooed on his forehead.
Yeah.
Wow. Steven, you are forced to write a pilot for a gritty reboot of Mr. Ed. What are you doing?
It's probably going to be like a similar escalation as when the old Perry Mason got turned into HBO or Max's recent, you know, 2-season Perry Mason, where you kind of keep the title and the basic premise, but everything changes. So I think the way I would rig a Mr. Ed retelling that was going to be dark and gritty is, you know, a down on his luck or her luck or their luck, you know, detective is reduced in the first episode to sleeping in a horse stall. And which I have experience with sleeping in
near the bird barrels. Yeah.
And through some mishap, they end up drinking a little bit of that horse's blood, and they find out that horse's blood has properties that lets them, for like 12 seconds at a time, see into the truth of whatever they're looking at. And so this detective, in order to solve their cases, has to keep returning to this horse stall and sneaking in and taking a sip of this horse's blood and trying to have the parties that are suspected around so he or she or they can see if they're the guilty parties, you know. And of course there's going to be drama with whoever owns this horse. That's going to be an issue, and it might be a real
What are you talking about right now? Drinking a horse's blood.
Yeah.
May I offer a suggestion?
Yeah.
I'm gonna let you run with the vampire aspect of this. But what I'm going to suggest is that after the pilot, the detective is now reinstated and is able to recruit the horse to be his. Oh. He's like one of those horse cop patrolmen or whatever. So that that way you don't have to keep going back to the barn.
That makes a little sense. It'd be cool if this detective, from drinking this horse blood so regularly, starts to like hay and starts to like apples, and starts to exhibit horse characteristics.
There's some sort of exchange going on. So the horse is becoming more man, and the man is becoming more horse.
Exactly. All right. And then at the season finale of the first season, we pan to the horse, and the horse opens its mouth and says its first word.
You're going to save Mr. Head talking to the final episode.
That's how they do it. They do it in the season finale.
That's true. That's true.
Christ, there's something wrong with you.
You asked for this, Scott.
I did.
I'm just happy there wasn't a fucking murdered kitten somewhere in there.
I put this question forth to the room, but I don't even want to hear your answer, Bespy.
Oh no!
On this, like he nailed it. Oh, done in one. You know.
Yeah. I'm happy Zach to just Snyder, throw in my two Mr. cents. Mr. Ed
will go ahead as planned.
But talking about the other television shows, because this is the first time I'm watching Sleepwalkers. That opening sequence where Mark Hamill in the mustache is traipsing around the scene in, was it San Diego or somewhere? Because I'd never seen Sleepwalkers, I'm already infected with Reno 911. So he looks like 90% like Lieutenant Dangle.
Yeah. His most Dangle-esque. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that takes place in the same place that the birds takes place.
Oh, it does.
Whatever.
Oh, nice. But one thing I think is that's probably often missed because people dismiss this film. Like I looked at some of the reviews from its time of release, and people just hated this film. Like it was the most atrocious thing they could imagine. But I think they're like all Wampo's missing roommate. Out. I think they're all missing out that it feels very, very obvious that Stephen King modeled this on Grendel, because you've got the mom and the son, the two killers.
Right.
And you graduate from the first to the second, and you have to finally face off against the mom. And I think it's a really effective retelling of Grendel,
Does that make Madchen Amick Beowulf?
It kind of does. It definitely does.
I'm gonna add that to the list of questions for the next time we get King on the show.
When you were writing Sleepwalkers,
actually about Beowulf. I'm literally writing it down.
Right? The oldest surviving human, oral story. Did that play into your mom son cat fucking story that you wrote?
But as for the dramatic line of this, this feels like it is fully three quarters Salem's Lot, or the Salem's Lot with like true not vampires who are sucking life force. It feels very, very familiar in a good way to me.
Right. Yeah, there is a little True Knot in there for sure. And he's got the small town with the rod and the, I'm thinking of Glenn Shaddix's character who becomes like the molesty teacher or whatever. It's like the adults you can't trust. And the clueless parents and, you know, all that stuff. Yeah, it kind of all plays into there. Yeah.
You know, and that teacher, when he confronts Charlie, is it Charlie? That's the blonde guy. Yeah, Charlie on the side of the road. That's when I noticed, because Mick Garris does all these very straight on shots of people's faces over and over through this film. I think he was probably influenced by Silence of the Lambs, if I had to suspect. But the glasses that teacher is wearing, I'm pretty sure they're the kind of like signature glasses King wore for a couple of decades. You know, they look they look very, very similar.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I was reading some trivia about this movie earlier today, and I learned that on the morning that, like, on the day that they filmed that, you know, King, Landis, Barker, cameo, all that shit,
Hooper,
Mick was eating granola that morning and shattered a molar.
Oh, man. Wow.
Had to go get an emergency, like, temporary crown put in and then go to set. And that was his first time meeting Stephen King.
Whoa.
Man,
well, you have to pay a small body sacrifice to meet the master, you know?
For sure.
Just how it is.
For sure.
I suppose.
Yeah, but I had to give up a toe to get him on the show. Like, what did you do?
That's definitely what happened to a couple of cast members on a John Landis production.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah. Man. That
cameo laden scene, though, that was, I thought that was really masterfully done. The way we followed King around, he's bouncing off, he's trying to get help here, and that was, and he was doing good acting then too. I thought, you know,
we just did like a ranking on our. We brought in the Screen Draft, Screen Drafts guys, and let them like rank their top whatever number of King cameos in Stephen King movies. Yeah. And I think wasn't this like close to the top?
I think it was number one. Yeah.
That's what I thought too, but it got a little hairy there at the end where it was did. Like, well, you know, it could be Maximum Overdrive, it could be this or whatever, but like it's very fucking funny. And it's very funny and kind of touching. Like if you're a horror fan, you're getting like all these luminaries all in one scene. That shit rules.
No, it does. The only one missing to me, well, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot missing, but the one who is good at doing cameos is Roger Corman, and he's not there, you know. I wish he would have been.
Well, I guess Roger Corman doesn't have a real connection to King other than sharing genre master's status. You know, Barker is like, you know, the kind of viewed at the time as King's like protege is the wrong word because he wasn't training him, but he was like the new heir apparent, right? So you have young Barker, you have Toby Hooper, who worked with him on Salem's Lot. Who's the other cameo in that? It's not
Landis.
No, Landis is later. Landis has a cameo with Joe Dante and John Landis those are the two cameos. Toby Hooper, who does he send him to? No, it's three. Yeah, so it's Toby Hooper, Clive Barker, and then he goes to the sheriff. So those are the two in that scene.
Yeah,
there's Landis and Dante show up later as lab techs.
I didn't recognize Dante at first either with that big shock of black hair, you know. But
I know.
Yeah, it took me a moment, man. Yeah.
I guess Dante's never worked in the King realm. That would have been.
Yeah,
that would have been fascinating.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, I wonder.
Dante could have done a good Needful Things. I think.
Oh fuck yeah!
You know,
like
he's got the mischief that
that
a good, you know, Needful Things adaptation.
Yeah, look at the destruction of the small town in Gremlins at the end. Like that's
100%.
Yeah, absolutely. You could have pulled off a Needful Things.
Yeah,
I love listening. I love
Christopher Lee would have been gaunt if he had done it. So.
Oh man,
yeah.
I love listening to Dante talk. That dude, he's just such a like scholar and historian of all things film, you know?
he is great. Can I tell you something? So I did the Overlook Film Festival last year. Scott couldn't make it, so it was just me out there, and there was an opportunity to interview Dante, and I was like, well, I don't, you know, it wasn't really for the show. It was just like, hey, you can have like 20 minutes with him if you want. And I'm like, what the fuck could I do this? Like Slash Film, who I was writing for at the time, didn't want it.
Oh,
and
man.
Phil was like, hey, if you interview Dante, I'll run it. And I'm like, oh, great. And I sat down and because he was there for the anniversary of Matinee, did a Matinee screening with John Goodman. It was awesome. And I sit down with him and we spent 20 minutes talking about how much he fucking hates Donald Trump and conservatives. He wouldn't talk about anything else. And I left it going, I just completely failed that interview. Like, I didn't send it to Phil because I'm like, there's
happened.
Yeah, I it's a secret shame of mine because I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to talk to him about Matinee. We talk like 1 minute about Matinee, and somehow the only thing he like bites on is just talking about fucking conservatives and how Donald Trump's a traitor and should be hanged in the town square kind of shit.
Yeah. Well, like, fair, but
I can't really, you know, I don't disagree with, but I'm just like, I'm like, what? I can't, like, this isn't for Fangoria.com, you know? It's like, I don't know what the fuck to do with this. Like, here, this is what it's like sitting down trying to ask a Matinee question and then going off on on conservative, you know, anti-conservative politics, which is great. But to your point, like, it was fascinating, but like, there's no home for it. Fucking Dante. Like, I wish I could have maybe gotten him more on the track. And again, a failure on my part as an interviewer, because I probably could have transitioned more into, like, just tell me about the 50s and 60s shit you like. But
there's only so much you can do. Like, in your role as an interviewer, sometimes you're gonna ask, like, you know, normal questions.
Yeah.
And someone's gonna come back at you and be like, I fucking brained a kitten with a cinder block. And you don't have, you know, and talk about the mist of the blood on their pants and what have you.
Bare legs.
You know,
bare
there's not much to be done about that. That's just that's a bad interview. And you know, sometimes sometimes it's the subject, not the host.
Oh man.
Scott doing damage control so far, doesn't want to get PETA boycotting the KingCast. Yeah.
Oh man.
No, I think people at this point have a reasonable expectation that they're gonna hear some some gnarly shit when Stephen Graham Jones comes on the show, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Before we wrap this up, I do want to bring up Alice Krieger and talk about her a little bit before we put the Sleepwalkers conversation to bed. Because I feel like every time we talk about this, like, the only thing we tend to focus on with the mother character is the weird incest thing. But I want to just put forward a little Alice Krieger appreciation, because she is acting in this movie as if this is a fucking period Oscar drama, right? Yeah. Like, she is bringing 100% to it. And it's part of the reason why the weirdness of the movie is so appealing and sticks with you and you think about it, is because, you know, you have, you know, certain people in the movie, not naming names, Mr. Brian Krause, you know, they're in the movie that they signed up for, right? Kind of the schlocky monster movie. And then she comes in here and she's like, no, I'm going to fucking treat this like a Olivia Hussey in Romeo and Juliet. Like, it's like, I'm going to be intense. This is Macbeth for me, you know? So I just wanted to put that out there. And do you think that her, the way that she attacks this role, does it stand out to you in the same way that it does to me as being a bizarre and really respectable and interesting choice?
Yes, for sure. She was the standout as far as that's concerned for me. Although my only issue was, her and Matchkin, if you say it Amek or Amek, I'm not even sure how to say it. Do you know?
I believe the pronunciation is Machen or Machen.
Okay.
Amek.
Okay. Well, anyway, those two, I was having such difficulty telling them apart. They're both women with brown hair. And I have a thing with like faces. I have the biggest problem telling people apart. If I can see what they're driving, I can tell them apart. If they wear the same shirt like Charlie Brown all the time, I can tell them apart. But if I just have to go on faces, I am lost. Like, I was in the post office at Christmas, and, you know, there's a big long line. That's the way it is at Christmas. And I finally made it to the front, and I go to leave. And when I'm going to walk out the first set of doors, there's a dude walking, trying to get in the door. So I back up to let him in, and he backs up. And we did this seriously for about 30 seconds. And I'm with like a whole line of 50 people watching me. And I just kept going back and forth. And then I finally noticed, oh, this is weird. This dude's wearing the same shirt as me. And then I realized, oh, wait, that's me in the mirror. Like, the reflection. I don't even recognize myself, you know? So of course I'm not going to be able to tell these two actors apart.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous and embarrassing, man.
Well, I'm glad that you feel comfortable enough to share.
Yeah,
not recognizing your own face for 30 seconds.
It's a caring and nurturing environment where we
But I was,
yeah,
we don't shame our guests.
Yeah. For like the first 30 minutes of this film, I couldn't tell those two apart. I'm like, why is he kissing her now? I thought they already kissed, or it was weird for me.
I assume that might have been on purpose, making with the incestuous thing and the girl that he's seducing look like his mom a little bit. I don't have much trouble confusing those two people, mm-hmm. but I think it's more of an energy thing, just like because Madchen in this movie is just so full of life and sweetness and kindness, and Kriga is just like the menacing, they're beautiful. They're both beautiful. They both, radiate, have a strong charisma and all that, but I don't know. There's a coldness to Kriga, like a calculation, like that Madchen doesn't have in this. So I think maybe that's the reason.
Yeah.
Plus I can also, I can tell people apart, unlike some best-selling authors on this.
Yeah. One time my wife went to get her hair. She was coming from the hair salon. Meeting her for lunch, and I was standing outside the lunch place waiting for her. And this woman comes up and starts talking to me, and I keep turning my back to her because I'm like, I'm not going to talk to you. My wife is coming. And that was my wife, of course. She had gotten her hair different,
We need... So if you've ever met Steven before and had a great conversation, wear a name tag when you go up to him again. You are not the only KingCast guest that this has happened to.
Really?
This is another Overlook story. So my guest at the Overlook Festival last year was David Ferrier. And, that we were supposed to do a record. We watched The Dead Zone. He had never seen it. And so it was like, mm-hmm. then we talked about it afterwards. And it was wonderful. Before then, I ran into him. I'm like, hey, I was starting like dropping in jokes and stuff. And he was like, yeah. And then I realized he had no fucking idea who I was. And mm-hmm. And we'd met in person multiple times before. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, I made sure my name badge, my festival badge was facing forward. And I just went and kind of positioned it, kind of puffed my chest out, I was showing off my boobs, but I was showing off my badge. And he's like, oh, Eric. And then he admitted, he's like, yeah, I have a real fucking thing with faces. And so people who, unless they're my best friends, mm-hmm. I will forget what their face looks like. So, so you have to remind me who you are when you're talking to me.
That's
so
wonderful. I wish people would wear name tags on their forehead. That would be so much easier, man.
Well, that goes back to your Mr. Ed.
Yeah.
Your gritty Mr. Ed. He's he's going to have Mr. Ed in an Ed Hardy font tattooed on his forehead.
Yeah, that'd be nice, man. But these monsters, these sleepwalkers. I know that Mick Garris tried to signal to us what their capabilities are and with that opening little definition screen, but nevertheless, they kept having abilities that surprised me. Like we talked about the cars going transparent, but then the mom uses telekinesis to make their record play, and there's just they seem to have more powers than we could ever guess, and they're showing up kind of late sometimes too,
if that makes sense. Which makes it feel a little cheap in that they're just coming up when they need something. Because the dude doesn't just make his car disappear, he changes the fucking color and license plate and everything. So they got some sort of mental projection that they can do.
Yeah, they definitely do, man.
And they're very angry at cats.
They definitely are.
Stop looking at me, you fucking cat. Clovis, the relationship with Clovis and his owner, the cop. My favorite part of the thing. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, if there was a Clovis movie where it's just those two going around fucking solving crimes and shit, I would have been all in.
Yeah, like Turner and Hooch or something. That would be great.
Right.
Man. Yeah. And, I guess I'd have to do a study of this. I don't know. Y'all might know. The two cats in King's work I can think of are Clovis and Church. They both start with a C, and Cat starts with a C. Is that his default setting for cats, y'all think?
Whoa, could be.
Good question.
What's the cat's name in the cat from hell?
Corn.
Corn? This is
no, going that's somewhere. Not true. I'm just making that up.
Curtis. Yeah.
Is it Curtis?
No, I have no idea. Yeah.
I'll look it up.
All Stephen King's cat's name, or the cat in Cat's Eye.
Problematic Google search. Apparently, there's a reality show called My Cat from Hell.
Oh, no.
Wow.
The cat from Cat's Eyes General. So that breaks the
it does.
Mystique a little bit.
But a G looks a lot like a C with an extra part.
That is. It's a G is just a C with an extra part. That's exactly what that is.
Very good, Steven. Yes.
This is a fucking wild episode, man.
Yeah. Do we have anything else we want to say about sleepwalkers?
That doesn't involve murdering newly born kittens, please.
You know what? One issue I had through the whole story was I couldn't figure out why these two sleepwalkers are so fixated on Tanya. And then I was reading a review or a trivia or something, and Mick Garris says in an interview that they're after her because she's virginal. And so I guess that they need virgin life force. But is she the only virgin in town? You know, I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah, you get problems.
No, but it's Machen Amick. Like, you know, you would fucking, you know. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're going to pick a virgin. Like, if that's your, you know, you want one that looks like her. I mean, she's gorgeous in this movie. Uh-huh. I had such a fucking crush on her after Twin Peaks. Like, like, I watched Twin Peaks. I was, like, you know, 11, 12 years old. You know, budding sexuality. And there were, like, you know, there's Laura Palmer, there's Audrey Horne, there's there's Shelley. Shelley was always my, you know, like, my crush.
The log lady?
Say what?
The log lady.
The log lady.
Yeah, not so much the log lady, you know, but Shelley was always my, like, choice, as though I had one at 11 years old, you know. She's fucking luminous in this movie. She is like, she's incredibly beautiful, but she's also like, you know, a great performer and really game in this, like going for it.
Yeah, she is.
Ridiculous, silly material, and she just fucking commits to it.
No, totally. And you know, I didn't see Twin Peaks until the late 90s, I don't think. In the early 90s when it came out, all I was watching was Star Trek Next Generation. That was the only television show I watched, you know? So I missed out on Twin Peaks lodging in me. I mean, I love Twin Peaks, but it didn't lodge in me the same way it did for other people of my age. You know?
Fair. Yeah. You watched The Return?
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
No, I bought The Return as soon as it was available on Blu-ray, and it's still sitting in front of my television because I'm afraid that once I watch it, there will be no more Twin Peaks, and that makes a sad world for me. So I'm saving.
Well, have you watched Fire Walk With Me?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So The Return is like the Fire Walk With Me season.
Oh, okay.
But even way weirder.
Mm-hmm. I hear that, what is it, episode 8 is like one of the best horror episodes. Eight. Yeah.
I used to do a thing like, after episode 8 came out, like, I was having a couple of people over one night, and I was going to, like, just put something on in the background, you know, like, just background noise, like, something on the television while we were hanging out. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, like, standing in front of my television, you know, and this is like a 65 or 70 inch television, you know, and I've got it hooked up to a Blu-ray player or whatever the fuck I was watching it on, but I was standing right in front of it is the point, you know, like within 3 feet from it. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to put on episode 8 and just have that like running on repeat. And, like, I made that choice. And then I was like, well, I'm going to fast forward to, I want to see that there's like a sequence in this episode where, a bomb goes off. Right. Huh. And I was like, well, I kind of want to see that sequence. So I like fast forwarded to it, and I watched it from about, you know, 2-3 feet away. And it's fucking mind bending to watch that footage on like a big screen that can actually like provide the definition that you want.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like grainy. So my friend showed up and I was like, you got to fucking do this. Stand right here and I'm going to play this. And we came up with the episode 8 challenge, which is like, watch this sequence from like 2-3 feet away.
Ah.
And we replicated this later in like, Vespi, you know, Ryan Sears.
Yeah.
Okay. So I stayed at his place, a couple years later, like the night before like a Nine Inch Nails concert that was happening in DC. And so like me, him, Emily, Melissa, who's been on the show before, Melissa K. he had like a gigantic screen in the basement of his place. Pulled it down and we watched that shit from like, again, like 2-3 feet away. And it's trust me, this sounds stupid. This sounds like a dumb thing to do, but try it if you have like a high definition television or a projector or something like that. And I promise you, it will melt your eyeballs out of your head.
Wow.
It is fucking awesome. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Plus, thank you. Channels
in that episode.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Man, you know, one
anyway,
more thing.
Sleepwalkers.
Yeah, Sleepwalkers.
1992.
One more thing I would say about it is if I ever have anyone shooting a pistol at me, I hope they aim as poorly as that cop shooting at the mom at the end of this movie. He shoots everything but her, and he is maybe 11 feet away, if that, you know?
I'm willing to bet you have had a gun trained on you at least four times.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
Like this week.
No, not this week.
But it turned out it was just a reflection of himself.
It was the president of the ASPCA.
Yeah, probably. No, I've had a live gun settled right between my eyes before, but it's...
We'll save that for next time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Let's not, you know, we don't want to blow our load right now.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen Graham Jones, as always, thank you for being here. This was
a roller coaster
Sleepwalkers episode. This was, but it was wildly entertaining, and we're very excited for The Angel of Indian Lake, and encourage all of our readers to pick it up. This is usually the point in the conversation where we, you know, kick it over to you to, you know, go into self promo mode. You know,
cool.
Tell people where to find you, where to buy the book, all that shit.
Yep. Angel of Indian Lake comes out March 26th, available wherever you get your books or audiobooks or ebooks. And then July 11th, I have I Was a Teenage Slasher coming out, another big slasher novel.
I know.
And find me, I'll just type my name into some search engine, I'll pop up somewhere, you know. I'm still on Twitter, but we never know from day to day if we're all going to be on Twitter, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here. This was honestly fantastic.
It was a blast. Thank you all for talking with me. And thanks for getting me to watch this film. I really did like it a lot. It was a great time. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Stephen Graham Jones, Dr. Jones, as I call him, one of our favorite guests on the show. I love having the dude on, and the dude writes so frequently that he gives us an excuse to have him on multiple times a year, which I definitely appreciate. What I might not appreciate so much, though, is the hours of therapy that I've had to undergo after listening to his mercy kill story that he told on the show. But
we're gonna have we'll have a conversation with him before the next show. About like what flavor of stories we're looking for exactly. I fucking knew that one was going to be bad, which is why I was like, I'm going to go take a piss and left. And I could not believe it when I got back and he still hadn't finished it. Like I took a leisurely stroll. Like I thought for sure I would have given him enough time, but no. And I was there just in time for that cinder block to come tumbling down. So The Angel of Indian Lake, in stores now, by Stephen Graham Jones. We love him. We do not judge him, but we're sorry for anyone that was upset by that.
Yeah, I mean, in my personal opinion, you know, any story that he wants to tell is a story I'm willing to listen to, especially you know, from his quite insane upbringing in childhood. Sometimes the stories are fun and adventurous. Sometimes they make me very sad and paint pictures in my mind that I can't make go away when I close my eyes at night. So, that's the risk you take when you ask him to share stories from his life. So I want to talk a little bit about, I want to hype you guys up for next week's episode. Like next week's main feed episode is one that I am so psyched for you guys to listen to. We have a first timer guest, Stephen King royalty, an actor, director, just all around great dude. We have Keith Gordon, star of Christine, on for a very lengthy episode where he's diving in. He's a cinephile and he wanted to talk about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. But he said, you know what? I have never read the book. Let me read the book for you guys for the first time. And so we, next week's episode is like, I don't know, to me, it's the kind of platonic ideal of a KingCast episode, yeah, where it jumps back and forth between the masterful Stanley Kubrick adaptation and kind of a deep dive into the Stephen King novel. I reread it to be fresh on it as well. And it's fresh on his mind. So you have the star of Christine, and we grill him about Christine. We talk a lot about his work with De Palma. We talk a lot about his work with Carpenter and Christine, you know, but then like it becomes a, like I said, kind of a textbook KingCast episode where we're going through kind of the minutia of the novel, mm-hmm, and you know, and the Kubrick adaptation, what he got right, what he got wrong, how you can define right and wrong with that film and with that book, and I don't know, it's just, to me, it's one of my favorite episodes we've recorded in recent memories. So, and we've recorded, yeah, some real bangers recently, so that's saying something.
It's great, and he's just a complete mensch. An honor to have him on the show. I don't know. Like, you don't see Keith Gordon pop up on podcasts very often. Mm-hmm. And so I was surprised when this one went through, and further surprised that, you know, he was willing to put in that amount of homework in order to do this. And, man, he's just a blast to talk to. That guy is cool as fuck. You know, he goes right along with, he goes right along with our bullshit, you know.
All right.
You know, he's all on
the tone right away. He understood the assignment.
Yeah. Well, I think I lead off the episode just saying Keith motherfucking Gordon, like, and he did not immediately be like, what have I wandered into?
right.
So get excited for that one, folks. And then this Friday on the Patreon, we have the latest episode of Shelbyville season 2. We are entering the end game for this season, as far as I know. This is what, episode 9?
Episode 9, yep.
Yikes. Yeah, we are getting down to it. Let's see, 4 episodes left?
Yeah, 9 of 13, yeah.
Yeah, there's these final 4 episodes, or 6 hours of the show, or whatever it is, are pretty wild. A lot of pieces start falling into place, a lot of things are going to start paying off, and we're very excited for you
a little bit for our characters. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty gnarly for everyone involved. But you can get that as well as a bazillion other, and I counted, it is a full bazillion.
Yep.
It's a bazillion and 3, but, a bazillion and 3 other, KingCast Patreon bonus episodes, which include commentaries, interviews, curveball episodes, regular, you know, standard issue KingCast episodes built around short stories or books or whatever it is. It's the other half of the show. If you're only listening in the main feed, you're only getting half the show, folks. Go over there, give us a couple bucks, and you'll get access to all of that all at once. Who wouldn't want that?
Only insane people, I think.
And that's so true.
I am saying you are insane if you're not on our Patreon.
Yes.
And I stand by it. So
and you get access to the Discord. Yes. I feel like we need to keep talking of the Discord. I check in on it several times a day. There's always something interesting going on in there. I found those guys organizing a Mac and Me screening the other night, and I was just so proud of them.
Join us. Great. So yeah, come by, see what's up with Bug, Bruce, and Crystal this Friday on our Patreon. That's patreon.com/thekingcast, by the way. Sign up, throw us some bucks. We definitely appreciate it. I know I want to pause right here and say, I know it's a cliche at this point, but the Patreon's truly what keeps the lights on at the KingCast. So
yes,
we'll see everybody in the main feed next Wednesday for our shining episode with Keith Gordon.
Adios, folks.
Bye. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.